It is Tuesday, April 16th, 2013. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums.
And I'm Antoinette Grajeda. Support for Ozarks at Large comes in part from the University of Arkansas's Women's Giving Circle.
Ahead on this edition of Ozarks, new legislation regarding landowner rights in the Fayetteville Shale Play. Arkansas Attorney General Dustin McDaniel discusses the aftermath of the Mayflower oil spill and the value of intergenerational gardening. We'll hear from a grandfather and grandson growing food together in the Arkansas River Valley.
But first, after a failed vote yesterday afternoon, the Arkansas House this morning passed the appropriation bill that will fund a federally backed expansion of the state's Medicaid system.
Question before the House, passage of House Bill 1219. Prepare the machine, Mr. Clerk. Voting on the bill and the emergency clause. Is everyone voting? Is everyone voting? Cast the ballots. 77 yeas, 23 nays. Order, order. House, come to order.
The scene of today's vote was reportedly vastly different from the one of yesterday afternoon. Legislators discussed House Bill 1219 for just shy of a half hour before the 77-23 vote in favor of the measure. Yesterday, the bill failed in a 69-28 vote, meaning that five nay votes swung to yay votes in the last 24 hours. One such swing vote was from Representative Sue Scott, a Republican from Rogers. Speaking from the House floor, she said that when she cast her vote on the bill, many faces would be on her vote.
Maybe the mother of five who called me this morning at 6:30, who said, "We all work at our business because we have to. We can't afford to hire anyone else." I am going to vote for this. I had originally said I would not, but I've had too many phone calls from too many good, hardworking people, not lobbyists. Not that they're not hard workers, too, but the real people.
But vocal opposition to the expansion was still present in the House chamber. Representative Bruce Westerman, a Republican of Hot Springs, continued his stated opposition to the bill, calling out members of the press, the governor's office, hospitals, insurance providers, and lobbyists, and anyone else who he saw as supporters of the bill. He also called out his Republican House colleagues who were on the fence about the bill.
To my friends who are considering voting for this appropriation, but doing so against the convictions in your heart, I ask you this. Is this vote worth 30 pieces of silver? It's okay to be afraid, but face your fears. Have courage and do the right thing anyway. Oppose Medicaid expansion and vote against this appropriation.
The bill now heads to the Senate for consideration. 27 senators must sign off on the bill before it can become law.
2.5 weeks after a pipeline ruptured, sending what was described as a river of oil through a residential neighborhood in Mayflower, the damaged section of pipe has been removed. ExxonMobil spokeswoman Kim Jordan spoke with reporters as crews worked cutting around the 22-foot gash.
There's a 52-section piece of pipe that's going to be removed. We've taken precautions so that we're cutting further out, far enough out on either side of the crack so that the affected portion stays intact as it's lifted out. And it's sent to an independent lab for analysis. We hope to learn the cause of the breach.
Hundreds of thousands of gallons of raw tar sands oil was spilled. ExxonMobil is paying for the cleanup and says it will also pay for all damage caused. Meanwhile, the Arkansas Attorney General's office is conducting an independent investigation. We'll hear from Arkansas Attorney General Dustin McDaniel later on the program.
The Fayetteville City Council tonight will consider awarding a construction management services contract for the Entertainment District Parking Deck project. Aldermen will consider awarding the contract to Baldwin and Shell Construction of Rogers. The entire project is estimated to cost around $6.1 million, and the contract would compensate Baldwin and Shell 5.5% of the total construction cost. David Jurgens is the city's manager for the project, and he says fees for construction management services can be higher or lower depending on the complexity of the project, but the fee set for this project is somewhere in the middle.
If it's a very large project, if you have a $60 million project, then it's going to probably be a lower fee. This one is, in the scale of construction projects, is relatively small. If it was smaller, it would be a higher percentage fee. This one is a little bit complicated because we have both the city involved as the owner, and we are the owner, but we have a customer being the Walton Arts Center who will be occupying the Walton Arts Center Administration Building, and so we'll be providing a great deal of input on that facility.
But just because the city is just now issuing the construction management services contract doesn't mean that progress on the project has been stalled. Juergens says the design process is strongly underway.
Working out the details of all the designs, working it through the planning process. It has been submitted for large-scale development through the city's planning office because we have to meet all of our own requirements. So we didn't slow down to bring the contractor on board, but now the contractor does have a representative or several involved in the design process, working on all those cost aspects of it, the buildability, how much, you know, when we're making decisions of are we going to build it with this technique or this technique, he can say what technique he feels would cost more or less, which one would be the easiest or hardest to build on this site, and what the impacts would be on time, et cetera.
The Fayetteville City Council meets tonight.
Although the program Safe Routes to School has already been in place in some Fayetteville schools, two Bentonville schools yesterday rolled out their own bike trains for the first time. Program got its start after the group Bike Bentonville received a $50,000 grant last year from the National Center for Safe Routes to School organization. The two new bike trains debuted yesterday are for students of R.E. Baker Elementary and Old High Middle Schools. Kyla Templeton is a member of Bike Bentonville. She says while the bike trains are between 2 and 5 miles long, the longest one as of yet for Bentonville students is about 3 miles. The different riding distances for students means different meeting times are needed along the way.
Most of them meet right around 7. The one from Bella Vista meets about 6:45. And then the others are at like 7:05 or 7:10. Or the one in downtown meets at 7:15. So they don't have to come as far. But they all want to be at school a few minutes early so that the kids have time to get settled and get their bike helmets put up and that sort of thing.
She says about 30 students participated in the two bike trains held yesterday, but more bike trains are scheduled to begin throughout the week. With more students on bikes comes a concern about safety, a concern she says has been paramount from the beginning.
We did surveys with the parents before we launched this, and the number one concern with parents was the amount of traffic and the speed of the traffic. So the amount of traffic we can't really do a lot about, but we can do something about the speed of the traffic. So we want people to slow down and be aware that there will be kids out riding the bikes. We put up signs along the route so that motorists will know where the kids are going to be riding. And so that should help them to be aware that that's going to be there.
Bike trains aren't entirely new to the Bentonville school system. According to Bike Bentonville, physical education teachers from Brightfield Elementary began a twice-a-week bike train in February.
The Northwest Arkansas Naturals last night dropped their second game in a row to the Frisco Rough Riders. The Nats fell 10-3 after Frisco pulled ahead with 6 runs in the bottom of the 7th and 1 run in the 8th. The Naturals finished the 3-game series in Frisco tonight before returning to Arvez Ballpark on Thursday.
Mostly cloudy tonight, 20% chance of showers and thunderstorms. Lows in the mid-60s in Northwest Arkansas, mid to upper 60s tonight in the Arkansas River Valley. Tomorrow, clouds, 40% chance of showers. Highs will be near 80 in Northwest Arkansas, lower 80s for the Arkansas River Valley. And tomorrow night, 80% chance of rain with lows in the mid-50s in Northwest Arkansas. Tomorrow night for the Arkansas River Valley, 70% chance of rain, lows in the mid-50s.
Late last week, the Arkansas legislature passed a long-sought-for bill to protect the interests of landowners on the Fayetteville Shale in north-central Arkansas, where more than 4,000 unconventional natural gas wells have been drilled. Ozarks at-large's Jacqueline Froelich reports.
The Landowner Notification Act will serve to safeguard property owners dealing with activities associated with exploration, drilling, and development of natural gas and oil resources. Democratic State Representative Greg Letting, District 86, Fayetteville, and House Minority Leader, was the bill's sponsor, introduced March 27th. A Senate version was also introduced April 4th by Bruce Malik, Democrat, District 12, Magnolia. Representative Letting said that he's pursued this legislation since he first took office in 2011.
We all know that the shale has brought jobs and money to our state, and we're thankful for that. But we know that that resource is finite, so those jobs and that money are finite. We want to make sure that we still have clean water, clean air, and a healthy land once that's all gone. And unfortunately, those bills in that last session met a swift death in committee. And so coming into this session, a group of those same advocates had worked with industry, primarily Southwestern Energy, during the interim to draft some new legislation together. And so I saw it as an opportunity to run some legislation that showed that the industry is willing to be responsible and to be cooperative and see if we couldn't get it passed.
Representative Letting said the bill received bipartisan support, unusual in this legislative session.
We had significant bipartisan support. We had a number of Republicans in the House sign on and Republicans in the Senate. Senator Rapert of Bigelow actually requested to be the lead sponsor. And the senator and I obviously differ on pretty much most everything, but this was an opportunity for the two of us to work together, and I felt that since he had been the founding member of the Shale Caucus here in the legislature, that his support would be critical to getting it passed through the Senate.
The Shale Caucus was formed in the spring of 2011 by 16 mostly Republican state legislators to protect the economic interests of industry on the Fayetteville Shale. The group worked to block any environmental reform that threatened industry, as well as raising the severance tax on natural gas. So to have one of the lead members of the caucus supporting this measure to protect landowners' interests was a paradigm shift. State Representative Greg Letting is also a member of the Arkansas Public Policy Panel, which helped to push the bill. Debbie Doss, a member of the Arkansas Public Policy Panel, as well as Conservation Chair of the Arkansas Canoe Club, lobbied the legislature to support House Bill 2001. She said it protects landowners who do not own mineral rights beneath their property.
This legislation provides surface owners with a notification when a production company is going to come onto their property and begin operations for pads and roads and pipelines and things like that.
So in the state of Arkansas, the mineral rights are considered part of the sale with the surface rights unless they've been specifically reserved or severed. If a landowner does not own mineral rights but refuses to sell those rights to a company wanting to produce oil or gas from a drilling unit in that area, according to state statute, they can be compelled to sign a mineral lease called forced pooling or integration if a majority of neighbors have negotiated such leases for development. The landowner will be compensated, of course, at fair market value for that lease. Now, if you live on property where the mineral rights are severed from the surface, state law requires the surface owner allow a reasonable portion of their land to be utilized for drilling and production. As such, the company holding the lease can enter the property for exploration and production at will. Again, Debbie Doss.
You get a notification when they begin to do seismic testing in your area on your property. But when they decide to drill, you generally don't know until the rig shows up. So this was needed to it's a small thing, but it's a courtesy to landowners to let them know what's going on their property.
Many Arkansas residents who are mineral rights owners welcome natural gas drilling rigs. The shale industry generated more than $18.5 billion between 2001 and 2011, but it also yielded more than $1.2 billion in mineral leases and royalty payments. But compared to other shale gas states, few property rights and protections exist in Arkansas. So after a landowner's rights bill was introduced in 2011, it stalled in committee, and then Debbie Doss said was referred for interim study for the 2013 session.
We started the Fayetteville Shale Working Group, and we met probably monthly for a year and a half, worked on some projects together with Southwest Energy, and They were extremely open to all of this. You know, they're a regional company. They actually asked us, you know, well, how can we improve our, you know, our relationships with, you know, with landowners, and what do you see that we need to do better? And so the Nature Conservancy, and they got together and worked on some best management practices and ideas, and they've also contributed to some improvement projects that we were interested in. And then finally, as part of our goal to work together, we decided to partner on some legislation.
Debbie Doss credits Arkansans for Responsible Gas Development as key to this measure. ARGD, an Arkansas Public Policy member, represents a coalition of Arkansas landowners, businesses, community leaders, and organizations who support responsible natural gas drilling in the state through the use of industry best management practices and strong agency oversight and enforcement. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
It's been more than 2 weeks since an oil pipeline ruptured in Mayflower, and the cleanup continues, as does the investigation into just what went wrong and why. Arkansas Attorney General Dustin McDaniel recently talked with Roby Brock from our content partner Talk Business Arkansas about the latest regarding the spill.
I think the biggest revelation this week to me was the fact that the rupture in the pipeline was 22 feet long. It indicates that this was not something that eroded slowly over a period of time, that something maybe perhaps major happened. Have you been able to determine anything more about the size of that and the importance of that?
Well, I've tried to not make unfounded steps from one fact to the next. There is no question but that the rupture is substantially larger than we would have expected, certainly than I would have expected. 22 feet is a big gash in a pipeline. This is not some small crack. And I wouldn't think something that had come to exist gradually, but I'm no pipeline expert. I don't know that. What I do know is that, as I have said continually throughout this, the more I learn, the more questions come up. And so I want to know more about pressure and other things that I did not know before.
So tell me a little bit about you went and got the 13,000, almost 13,000 pages of documents came into play here. You've had about 48 hours, maybe a little bit more than that, to actually look at some of those, go through some of those documents. Has anything kind of come to light already from that quick review and preview of what you've been looking at?
I met with lawyers and investigators that have been going through the initial review earlier today. It's very technical. There's a lot of industry jargon and codes and things that, frankly, we're going to need to get help from Exxon to decipher. I'm not prepared to make any comments or characterizations about what we've got so far, because I think it would be pretty incomplete, other than to say I do appreciate the speed with which they worked on my request, promptness with which they delivered so much information, and they have continually assured me that if and when I want more, they will respond quickly, and I expect that I will want a lot more.
A question that a lot of people are asking is, why does ExxonMobil appear to be in charge of the whole containment area and the public relations and communications around this? I know there's federal agencies and state agencies involved, but can you explain why that perception is out there, and is perception reality, I guess?
Well, I would not say that the perception is reality so much. You have a four-pronged administration at the Joint Command Center, which is state, county, and federal, and the responsible party, which is Exxon. So you've got state, county, and federal government agencies directing the operation, and Exxon simply paying for all of it. They are only one quarter of the decision-making authority, but they are 100% of the cost responsible party. So to that end, they're on the short end of the stick. But I would leave it to the media to characterize how their PR has gone this week. I'm not in their PR shop. I will say that we spent a day last week just trying to clarify to the press that the temporary flight restriction, which is a standard thing that is set up above a disaster area to keep sightseers and private pilots such as myself from flying in and out of there just out of curiosity, from interfering with the media and emergency services aircraft and construction aircraft. You know, the TFR specifically allowed for the media, and yet a day went by where it looked like Exxon had put a no-fly zone to keep cameras out of their airspace and that they were controlling the airspace. So something that should have been pretty standard became a PR problem that still lasts to this day. So, yeah, those things have happened, but I'm busy tending to the cleanup, I'm busy tending to the investigation, and I'm busy dealing with their lawyers. And I let the PR guys figure out how to better communicate with the public.
You have asked for $4 million to help with investigative expenses from ExxonMobil. Have they given you any indication yet if they're going to pay that? How did you come to that number, and do you think it's going to be enough?
Well, the first contract that we've signed is with James Lee Witt and his firm, Witt O'Brien's, a globally recognized disaster response team. We have experts that have worked dozens of oil spills or more, I guess, domestically and abroad. We have them on site right now. If every member of that team is working, I think it would probably be $2,400 an hour. We're upwards of $650,000. It would be the anticipated cost of that contract alone. We have air quality testing that I want done independently. You know, for instance, setting up an air quality monitor on a street with the wind blowing up and down the street to determine whether certain carcinogens are present is good, and that's important. But that's a whole separate thing from setting up an air quality monitor inside someone's house to test whether or not the air will just make you sick to your stomach. It may not have cancer-causing chemicals at a level that the federal government says are immediately life-threatening, but that doesn't mean you want to live there either. Mm-hmm. And so there are a whole broad array of things I want done. So to get to that point, we tried to estimate the cost and then add some to it. $4 million, I wouldn't say, was arbitrary by any means, but it's also one that I think would cover the cost but leave room for what more may come.
Do you see a scenario where ExxonMobil buys these homes out from these residents that have been displaced, or is that asking you to look too much into a crystal ball?
Well, I wouldn't want to look into a crystal ball, and I wouldn't want to pretend to be the private counsel for the homeowners. And what an individual homeowner may want or believe is fair for his or her damages, I will leave to them. But I don't think that it's any secret that a lot of people, including myself, believe that the property damages should go well beyond the single street down which the oil was flowing, and that a comprehensive approach to that that neighborhood should certainly be in the discussion pipeline sooner rather than later. No pun intended.
Ruby Brock talked to Arkansas Attorney General Dustin McDaniel about the Mayflower oil spill this weekend. You can hear more of the conversation at talkbusiness.net. Support for Talk Business Arkansas and Ozarks at Large is provided by Mitchell Williams Law, providing strategic counsel on a variety of sophisticated legal matters since 1954. Mitchell Williams Law Firm combines decades of diverse professional experience to clients across the U.S. Today, the firm employs nearly 80 attorneys from 4 offices in Arkansas, Texas, and New York. Online at MitchellWilliamsLaw.com.
And Bank of the Ozarks, committed to helping business owners succeed by combining the tools and services businesses need with accessible experience and knowledge. More information at BankOzarks.com. And the Electric Cooperatives of Arkansas. Diversity is the key to reliability and affordability. From the state's largest industrial user to a home at the end of a long country road, the Electric Cooperatives of Arkansas serve members with a stable supply of electricity backed up with fuel diversity. More at AECC.com.
I'm Guy Raz. Next time on the TED Radio Hour.
For the past few centuries, we have defined beauty not just as health and symmetry, but also as tall, slender figures and white skin.
Beauty. the good, the bad, and the ugly of it. That's next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
You can hear the TED Radio Hour each Sunday at noon on KUAF 91.3 FM.
It is Tuesday, April 16th, 2013. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
This is Ozarks at Large. With us, Becca Martin-Brown, features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
So you missed Bam Margera last night.
I did.
But I have another opportunity for you.
Awesome.
Yeah. We love opportunities.
Weird Al.
Weird Al Yankovic?
Is on tour.
Huh.
Does he have a new album?
He has the recently released Weird Al, The Apocalypse Tour.
Okay.
It's a special through Comedy Central, not an album. And he is passing through the area doing whatever you call Weird Al's music. Parody?
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think
that's
most accurate.
Yeah.
So he will be at the Family Arena outside of St. Louis on Friday, at the Gilios Theater in Springfield, Missouri on Saturday, and April 22nd at the Uptown Theater in Kansas City, Missouri. And you can find all those tickets on Ticketmaster.com. Now, from that to something completely different. For tomorrow, it is the Botanical Garden of the Ozarks Market from 4 to 7 o'clock. And the Mystery Book Club meets at the Bella Vista Library at 6 o'clock to talk about the books of Radine Trees Nearing.
An Ozark herself.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Thank you, Becca. Becca Martin-Brown is features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
150 years ago, the Civil War near Vicksburg, Mississippi turned violent on this date. Part of the Union forces' naval fleet, under the direction of Admiral David Dixon Porter, tried to get past Confederate forces. Despite a volley of ammunition fired at the Union ships, most of the fleet made it past Confederate forces to rendezvous with Union General Ulysses S. Grant in Louisiana. About a month later, General Grant would be in Mississippi as the siege of Vicksburg would begin. While the seeds of that battle were being sown 150 years ago this week, forces from Union and Confederate armies were preparing to engage in a battle over control of Fayetteville, Arkansas. This week, the Washington County Historical Society will mark the 150th anniversary of the Battle of Fayetteville, and we'll learn more in just a moment on Ozarks at Large. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. With me inside the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio is Charlie Allison, who is a board member of the Washington County Historical Society. Welcome.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
I don't think I've ever begun an interview by commenting about someone's hair, but you have longer hair than usual because...
We've got a historical reenactment from the Civil War coming up, and since I was serving on this committee to help organize the commemoration, I figured I probably ought to do my best to fit in with the reenactors, and the only thing I knew how to do was let my hair grow.
This reenactment is marking the 150th anniversary of the Battle of Fayetteville.
Right. April 18th, 1863, Fayetteville saw its own battle between Union and Confederate forces. So, looking back 150 years and trying to make sense of that, we felt like it was a good point in time to do some kind of commemoration each year, but we figured this year was a good year to really try to get people in to hear about it and understand the significance it had on this area.
Fortunately for the people involved in the Battle of Fayetteville, it did not have nearly the loss of life of Prairie Grove or Pea Ridge, but still, both sides were there.
Right. No, it was a much smaller battle than either of those. On the other hand, it was very significant to Fayetteville. There were probably about 10 to a dozen Union soldiers killed, somewhere between 20 and 30 Confederate soldiers killed. Forces totaling probably 1,400, 1,500 when you add the Union and Confederate troops together. So it wasn't without some significance. But certainly not as big as Prager Grove or Pea Ridge.
Fayetteville, before the battle, was it controlled by either Union or Confederate forces?
Yeah, Prairie Grove battle had happened in December, and the Union had held sway on it. Confederates had retreated south of the Arkansas River. And so the Union troops basically made Fayetteville sort of their western outpost at that point, and had occupied Fayetteville, had recruited troops, and so had Arkansas infantry companies, Arkansas cavalry companies, an artillery company. So they had pretty much tried to make this as much an outpost as possible. They'd built up some supplies and arsenal. So they were hoping to make this a place where they could stay for a while.
Were they headquartered at the headquarters house?
Yeah, Union troops were headquartered in what is now known as the headquarters house. It was the Tebbets house at that time. The Tebbets had left Fayetteville in the middle of the war to safer places north. Jonas Tebbets had been a staunch Unionist and as a result didn't feel very safe about his life. And so he got out of here with his family, as a lot of Union sympathetic families did.
So Dixon Street existed?
As a road, I don't think it had been technically named Dixon okay. Street at that point, but yeah, it existed as a road. What we know as College Avenue existed as a road. In fact, it was named for the college that had been standing real close to the corner of Dixon and College. So that's how College Avenue got its name. The college itself had been burned down before this battle, but it was at the center of the battlefield.
In that intersection, which is now Dixon College, was that the epicenter of the battle?
Certainly the hottest part of the battle. It stretched, the Union line stretched from that corner eastward probably to about where Mission and Lafayette intersect now. And then it stretched down College Avenue, almost probably to Rock Street, somewhere along in there.
I have been told in the past that Union soldiers slept or camped about where there is now an auto zone.
Right. And probably all along those two blocks there, in between Dixon and Maple. Some of them were moved to the far side of Mount Nord to sort of keep them out of the way of battle. Many of the Union soldiers had not been issued firearms yet, so they were effectively removed from the battlefield just for their own safety and probably the safety of their fellow soldiers.
The Tebbets House, now called the Headquarters House, was there. Were there other – was this a residential area where the battle was taking place?
It would not be what planners would call thick infill, but yes, it was residential. Right across the street from Headquarters House was another house that looked almost exactly like it because it was both of them were built by the same person, and it was the Baxter House. And the Baxter House received most of the destructive elements of the war. I think the Confederates who were firing artillery from what's now called Mount Sequoia were aiming at Baxter House, thinking that they were shooting at the Tebbets House. So there was a good amount of damage done to the Baxter House, some to the headquarters house. There's still bullet holes in one of the doors at headquarters house. So there were a good number of houses in that area.
So the Confederate forces were on top of what we call Mount Sequoia now?
They moved their artillery up there. The biggest number of them, the infantry and cavalry, were down in the hollow in between. And they'd come up from the south side of Fayetteville and just come up the hollow before daybreak even. And tried to charge from out of that hollow up onto the ridge. And partly because the Union had better firearms, better guns, longer, distance to be able to shoot, they were able to repel the Confederates on two different charges sort of at that intersection.
So Fayetteville remained in Union hands?
It did. Sadly, or I guess if you're a Union sympathetic person, they decided, though, after the battle that maybe they couldn't hold Fayetteville at this point. They were so far away from supply lines that the union officer in charge, Marcus LaRue Harrison, contacted, you know, St. Louis and said, do we stay? Are you going to supply us? Are you going to, you know, provide us what we need? Or should we withdraw? The union said, go ahead and withdraw to Springfield, Missouri. And so, in essence, they won the battle, but then turned over the town to whatever the Confederates wanted to do after that. Mm-hmm. And eventually the Confederates did come back in and occupy the town for a period and use headquarters house as their headquarters.
Hmm. Hence the name.
Yes.
You mentioned that you contacted St. Louis. I guess you sent a rider?
No. At that time, there was still a telegraph.
Okay.
From Fayetteville up through Springfield. It was a difficult task to keep it operating. Both sides were cutting it down whenever it, you know, was to their advantage. But it wasn't too hard to put back up and tie the lines back together again or string new ones.
Would that go along what we now call Old Wire Road?
Right. Exactly. And that's how Old Wire Road got its name.
That was the telegraph line.
Yeah.
Charlie Allison is on the board of directors for the Washington County Historical Society. The Society's commemoration of the 150th anniversary of the Battle of Fayetteville begins Thursday night with a lecture by Kim Allen Scott at the First Christian Church in Fayetteville, a church standing now at what was very near the epicenter of the battle 150 years ago. That event is free and open to the public.
Friday night from 6 until 9, there will be candlelight tours of the headquarters grounds at 118 East Dixon. There is a $5 charge for adults, $3 charge for children over 11, and those under 11 are admitted for free.
And Saturday from 10 until 3:30, there will be events at the headquarters house, including reenactment demonstrations of the battle at 10 and 2. The Saturday events are free and open to the public. You can learn more about the events Thursday through Saturday at washcohistoricalsociety.org. That's washcohistoricalsociety.org.
Marks the anniversary of the writing of the letter from Birmingham Jail, an open letter written on April 16, 1963 by Martin Luther King Jr. in response to a call for unity, written by 8 clergymen following Dr. King's arrest. The letter defends the strategy of nonviolent resistance to racism, arguing that people have a moral responsibility to break unjust laws. Many municipalities, organizations, and businesses will unite across the country today to honor the anniversary with readings of the significant letter. Ozarks at Large's Christina Thomas attended one such reading this morning just across the street from KUAF Studios at the Fayetteville Public Library and has this report.
Some of you may remember the whites-only signs on water fountains and restrooms, separate service policies in restaurants and segregated schools. For others, separate but equal are words taught in history class, but not connected with specific events experienced in everyday life.
We have come a long way. David Johnson, Executive Director of the Fayetteville Public Library, welcomed guests to the front terrace of the library this morning for a reading of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s letter from a Birmingham jail on this, the 50th anniversary of its writing. The event, sponsored by the Birmingham Public Library, is just one of many that will be held today across the city, the state, and the nation. 9 speakers joined together this morning to read the 9-page document. Melissa Lockabee is a reference librarian at the library and a co-organizer of today's commemoration.
I chose the speakers based on their interest in the community. For example, Dr. Robinson is the Vice Provost of Diversity at the University of Arkansas. Daniel Woods, of course, is with the MLK Council and also is the co-director of Equal Opportunity and Compliance with the university as well. So I tried to pick people who were very interested in civil rights legislation as well as being wonderful readers.
She mentioned Dr. Charles Johnson, Vice Provost of Diversity at the U of A. Dr. Johnson read the first section of Dr. King's significant writing.
My dear fellow clergymen, while confined here in the Birmingham jail cell, I came across your recent statement calling my present activities unwise and untimely. Seldom do I pause to answer criticism of my work and ideas. If I sought to answer all of the criticisms that crossed my desk, my secretaries would have little time for anything other than such correspondence in the course of the day, and I would have no time for constructive work. But since I feel that you are men of genuine goodwill and that your criticisms are sincerely set forth, I want to try to answer your statements in what I hope will be patient and reasonable terms. I think I should indicate why I'm here in Birmingham, since you have been influenced by the view which argues against outsiders coming in. I have the honor of serving as president of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, an organization because I was invited here. I am here because I have organizational ties here. But more basically, I am in Birmingham because injustice is here, just as the prophets.
Dr. Johnson was followed by Dr. Stephen Noisy, member of the Friends of the Library Board and retired political science professor at the U of A.
As a means of laying our case before the conscience of the local and the national community. Mindful of the difficulties involved, we decided to undertake a process of self-purification. We began a series of workshops on nonviolence, and we repeatedly asked ourselves, are you able to accept blows without retaliating? Are you able to endure the ordeal of jail? We decided to schedule our direct action program for the Easter season, not realizing that except for Christmas, this is the main shopping period of the year. Knowing that a strong economic withdrawal program would be the byproduct of direct action, we felt that this would be the best time to bring pressure to bear on the merchants for the needed change. Then it occurred to us that Birmingham's mayoralty election was coming up in March, and we speedily decided to postpone action until after Election Day. When we discovered that the Commissioner of Police Safety...
Dr. Stephen Noisy was followed by Elizabeth Jordan, Ty Dunn, Danielle Woods, Vic Kelly, Bennett Baber, and J.B. Hogan. Again, Melissa Lockaby.
I think it emphasizes that civil rights is still an important piece of legislation. We have come a long way, but we also have a long way to go.
All archival pieces from readings across the city, across the state, and across the nation will be sent to the Birmingham Public Library to be archived. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Christina Thomas.
Excerpts from a live reading of the letter from Birmingham Jail written by Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. The reading took place earlier today at the Fayetteville Public Library. Today marks the 50th anniversary of the letter.
The Next Fresh Air, the new Christian evangelical adoption movement that promotes adoption as a way of fulfilling a biblical mandate. It's sending tens of thousands of evangelicals overseas to adopt, but the children aren't always really orphans. We'll talk with Catherine Joyce about her new book, The Child Catchers, Rescue, Trafficking, and the New Gospel. Join us.
Fresh air this evening at 6 on KUAF 91.3 FM. Gardeners are cautiously working in the soil right now, hoping the final freeze of the season has passed. Ozarks at Large's Meredith Martin Motes recently talked to a pair of gardeners who work together and span a few generations to raise food for their family.
Whitney Wills began gardening as a young man in northeastern Arkansas. Now in his 80s, he's retired from teaching and is working with his college-age grandson, Brian Mater, to create a backyard garden in his home in Dardanelle, Arkansas. Over the past few years, Wills has taught Mater the basics of planting and harvesting. As one of the founding members of the Russellville Community Market, Mater has been sharing with his grandfather the information he's learning about the problems with an industrialized food system and the growing movement among younger generations to create a local, sustainable food system. Together, they've grown enough vegetables to feed themselves, sell to market, and donate to local food banks. This year, they plan to grow even more and make regular donations toward local food security. I had the opportunity to visit with Whitney Wills and Brian Mater earlier this year at Wills' home in Dardanelle, Arkansas. Here's an edited version of their conversation.
I get impatient as far as certain things in the garden are concerned. I always want to dig the potatoes before the potatoes are ready to be dug. And Brian says, let them stay a little longer. He seems to be the one who holds it down for me.
It's definitely like a delayed gratification type of thing, because you do all this work, you get it in the ground, and months later, you finally, you know, reap the rewards of it. So yeah, I think, you know, just by the virtue of how things grow and the, you know, just the virtue of gardening, it does teach you patience. And yeah, I'd agree with that.
Being able to depend upon another person to do what they need to do is good, and they learn to be dependable. And I know my son is that way, and Brian is that way. We're working together real well.
You know, I guess one thing I understood the concept of it, but I had never done it, was actually planting the seed. And that was something that I learned and didn't really know how to do or understand what to do. And
be a helper initially, and then as you learn, well, then you can do things more or less on your own, but you need somebody to guide you, unless you just want to be a person who wants to go out and learn from the school of hard knocks and do the best you can, and then you'll learn, but it'll take you longer than it will if you watch somebody else do it. Mm-hmm. Have a guide.
Find somebody who can teach you and you know, has the patience and the, you know, the want to show you kind of how to do it. And you know, and otherwise, you know, beyond that, just trying to do it yourself, I'd say view it as an experiment and view it as something that as a learning process for yourself. And you kind of, you know, you come into your own with it once you learn how to, you do it once, you know, maybe everything dies or whatever, but then the next year around, you know, you can fix those things and do things a little different, tweak this and that, and after a while you kind of figure out what you're doing. And yeah.
If things continue to increase in price at the store, you might want to revert back to the Victory Garden era.
Yeah.
And that, everybody can raise a garden.
Mm-hmm.
A little plot of ground 10 by 10, as Brian described down on the corner, you can grow things like that.
Mm-hmm.
You'd be surprised what you can grow on a small amount of land.
Especially if you're growing a high mass piece of fruit or something like a cucumber or squash or, you know, anything else, a tomato even, you know, it's if you're doing squash and you have maybe three or four plants of it and you get a 12 inch squash or something off every time, it doesn't take a whole lot. You'll have 10 pounds of food and, you know, your first picking. It's pretty amazing. Somebody who kind of on the cusp of, you know, thinking about starting a garden or really wants to start a garden but just isn't really sure how, don't be intimidated by the work, I guess, ahead. I mean, yes, it is work up front, but once you learn the way and once you understand kind of more what you're doing, and once you see that stuff is going to grow, really without a whole lot of maintenance, you know, it's definitely a rewarding process. So keep that in mind when you're starting a garden. Don't let the work be too much of an obstacle. You kept a count on one of the plants and how many, you know, pieces of okra you think you got off of it?
We got 66 pods off of one plant, and that's mm-hmm. through the growing season. And that's not unusual, but the plant was over 6 feet tall.
There's another piece of advice. If you're starting out, especially in this state, buy some okra. It will grow. I promise you. No matter how hot it gets, it will grow.
I enjoy that Brian is working with me, and I feel good about maybe he's learning something as we go along.
Yeah.
And my son, who now lives out here by Nebo, he was with me in Hoisington, and he has a garden now. So he maintains it pretty well. Well, he watched and we did it together, just like Brian is watching and we're doing it together.
Mm-hmm.
I think the camaraderie of doing it together is worth much more than the garden.
Mm-hmm.
This conversation with Whitney Wills and Brian Mader was recorded in Dardanelle in Yell County, Arkansas, and produced as part of an ongoing project with the McCoy House Organization for Folklife, Oral History, and Community Action. If you'd like to know more about our work at the McCoy House, including sharing the stories of gardeners and growing, you can visit us online at mccoyhouse.wordpress.com. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Meredith Martin-Motes.
Meredith Martin-Motes files reports for Ozarks at Large. She also writes a column for newspapers in the Russellville-Dardanelle area. You can also follow her thoughts at her blog, boileddownjuice.com. This is Ozarks at Large. Support for KUAF comes from the Community Clinic, helping people lead healthy lives by providing health care for all in Northwest Arkansas. Serving the community for over 15 years with locations in Springdale, Rogers, Siloam Springs, and Fayetteville. Healthy people, healthy community. On the web at communityclinicnwa.org.
Ozarks at Large is underwritten in part by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation. A listener-supported service of the Department of Journalism and Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas, this is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Rogers, Fort Smith, Lutherville.
Lutherville?
Mm-hmm.
Where is Lutherville?
Just east of Clarksville.
Okay. All right. I've never been, to the best of my knowledge, I've never been to Lutherville.
Me either.
All right. April is a crazy month here. Not here at KUAF. Well, it is at KUAF, but in the KUAF listening area.
There's so many things.
I would say it's the busiest month by far.
Yes.
October is awfully busy.
Right.
May is becoming busy, but April is the king of busy.
It really is.
Or the queen. Or the...
whatever.
Ruler. The champion.
Royalty.
Yes. Yes. Some examples.
Okay.
Just in the next few days, Caravanserai is in Fayetteville again, and the Orchestra of Fez, which will be at Walton Arts Center Friday night, for the 10x10 series. Actually, some chances for people in the area to see the Orchestra of Fez for free.
Cool.
They are at Bentonville High School at some point today.
Okay.
For a performance there. They have a question and answer session at Pomfret Hall in the Great Room on the U of A campus tonight.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a free event. And then they have a free and open musical workshop tomorrow evening at the Fayetteville Public Library. That's from 6:30 until 7:30 tomorrow.
Wow, I didn't know they were doing all of the little community things. I know a lot of people do. I just didn't realize these guys were.
When Caravanserai picks your town, they they bring in and it's sort
workshop
of an emotion. Yeah,
and
absolutely. There's a film, I think, Thursday night at the Fayetteville Public Library as well.
Cool. A ticket notice. Tickets go on sale for The Price is Right Live at Walton Arts Center. That'll be Thursday, May 16th at 7, but the tickets go on sale tomorrow.
And now, this is not the television show.
It's not.
But it's everything like the television show.
I didn't know this was a thing.
I did not either.
It's very interesting.
But I'll say this. If you don't have Plinko or the mountain climber guy,
uh-huh.
You know who I'm talking
about?
Yeah. Then I don't want to see it. You got to have one of those two games.
I feel like the press release mentioned specifically Plinko.
It did. And it did say mountain climber, which is
it
the
did.
One.
Okay.
Right.
Well, that'll be good.
The tickets, see if this price is right for you. Tickets, I think, are $44.
Uh-huh.
So you go and, but you can win a car or something.
Which is kind of cool.
Yeah.
So there you go.
All right. So, and tickets go on sale tomorrow.
Tomorrow.
At night. Northwest Arkansas Naturals are back in town, by the way, Thursday.
Yes.
And if you go Thursday night, it's Pioneer brand pancake night. So
awesome.
Everyone gets a sample of pancake mix on the way out.
Well, I'm going Friday, so.
Fireworks Friday, and it's Superhero Friday.
I know, I'm pretty excited about that. I saw that, but they said 13 and under that dress up like a superhero. I might do it anyway.
What superhero would you dress up as?
Oh, I don't know. I have to think about this.
Oh, we could take suggestions.
We could take suggestions.
Okay. All right. I think if you showed up at Arvest Ballpark Friday night as a superhero, they'd let you in free.
I think they should.
I think they should, too.
But, I mean, maybe I'll just, you know, be subtle and do, like, a T-shirt, like a superhero T-shirt or something.
That'll work.
Yeah.
All right. That's Friday night with fireworks.
With fireworks.
Yes. Another brand-new edition of Ozarks at Large tomorrow at noon. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
Alter ego of somebody. We don't know who. Have a great night.